hotel.
At the gate, we pass through a final gauntlet of Moroccan Mukhabarat, or intelligence agents. As we head to the plane, one of them says, "I hope you had a good time in Moroccan Sahara." Moroccan Sahara, the term the Moroccan government uses, but no country in the world officially recognizes. Morocco occupies Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. For Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman, with John Hamilton, Mike Burke, and Dennis Moynihan.
This has been a Democracy Now! Special, 4 days in Western Sahara, Africa's last colony. A nearly three-decade ceasefire in Western Sahara recently ended after the Moroccan military broke into a southern no-go buffer zone on November 13th to attack Sahrawi civilians and exchange fire with the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement seeking independence. As Morocco and the Polisario engage on the battlefront, dozens have been arrested in the occupied territory. Many of the Sahrawis in this film are currently under police siege or in hiding. 4 days in Western Sahara was directed by John Hamilton and produced with our news director, Mike Burke, and Dennis Moynihan. Special thanks to Maria Carrion, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Brendan Allen, Hugh Gran, and all those who helped us along the way. All music by the late Sahrawi singer, Mariam Hassan.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hey, KBOO listeners. It's another big give day for Willamette Week's Give Guide. Just for today, Give Guide has a Black Pack Black Friday offer. When you donate $10 or more, you'll get a chance to win a handmade, made-in-Portland backpack from Black Pack. If you're 35 or under, you'll also get a chance to win a Zero Wallet and an Anything Organizer, both from Black Pack. Donate to KBOO on Give Guide today to support your favorite community radio station and get a chance to win the Black Pack Black Friday offer. Just go to kboo.fm/give. And don't forget, all new and increasing donations will be matched one-to-one up to $25,000, thanks to an anonymous donor. So show your support today and give back this Black Friday. That's kboo.fm/give. For more information about this Give Guide offer and to donate to KBOO on Give Guide, just go to kboo.fm/give.
This hour, we feature a special program, a conversation between Mark Lamont Hill, Philip Agnew, and Kianga Yamada Taylor about the ongoing struggle for freedom in the wake of the 2020 election, marking the release of Dr. Hill's urgent new book, We Still Here: Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. You can find information on the book We Still Here by Mark Lamont Hill from bookshop.org or HaymarketBooks.org.
I wrote this book somewhat unexpectedly. I was working on a couple of other projects, and like everybody else, the world stopped for me. COVID hit. Nobody was going outside. But for me, it was also a personal note. I was sitting in a hospital with my father, who is 92. He was very ill. He got an infection. And I was hoping that he would get better. The doctors were uncertain. He wasn't eating. We were just trying to make sure he was okay. And as I was sitting in that hospital with him in February turned into March, and his condition was uncertain, and the hospital told us we couldn't come back because of COVID. And I didn't know if I'd seen him for the last time. And they sent him back to a nursing home, his nursing home. Still couldn't visit him. March turned into April, turned to May, turned to June, still couldn't see him. And so there's a way that the very real material impact of COVID for me was felt. And there was a day in May or June where, after George Floyd had been killed by the state, they were planning a big protest downtown. And I was already on the fence about going downtown because I'm 41 and I'm in good health, but like 41 ain't 21. And I was like, I don't know if this COVID thing definitely ain't for me. And I don't know if I want to be in a protest. But I was also concerned that that at any given moment, they could let us back into the nursing home. And I wanted to see my father. And I was trying to figure out these choices. Do I go out and risk COVID, risk getting sick for myself, and also risk infecting people who I love in order to protest the state killing us? Or do I stay at home and feel like I'm doing nothing to resist the fact that the state is ritually killing us, right? These choices put you in a kind of ignoble paradox. And you're in this conundrum where you don't know what to do. And you're wrestling with this question that I talk about in the intro to the book, which is, in what way will I resist death today? And for me, that's what it means to be Black in America, or to be vulnerable in America, not just Black. Blackness brings its own particular set of vulnerabilities, but what it means to be vulnerable in this country. And I was wrestling with that, and I wanted to think through why I felt that way and why I felt so acutely vulnerable in that moment and why so many others felt acutely vulnerable in that moment. I mean, COVID didn't create, it created new vulnerabilities, but it exposed other vulnerabilities. And I wanted to think through what that meant. You know, I remember, as America likes to do, you know, they do this universalizing move where they say, we're all in this together. You know, it's like after 9/11, we're all in this together. Except if you're Muslim or you're South Asian or you're Sikh or you know, you're in this a little bit more, right? We got COVID-19, we're all in this together because we're all equally vulnerable. Yeah, but if you're a frontline worker, if you are living in a housing project, if you're caged in a dungeon in any of the prisons around the United States, if you're in a nursing home, you're in this in a different kind of way. And so I wanted to think through not just the pre-existing health conditions that we all may or may not have, but to think about these structural pre-existing conditions of racism, of poverty, and how we could think through them in different ways to expose something else. But right as we're dealing with COVID, we're also dealing with state violence. And again, it's not new, but we're exposed to it in certain kinds of ways that were different. And looking at the intersections of those things was interesting to me. And what I want to talk about today with my friends and comrades is that question of pandemic. What it means to live in a pandemic, what it means to think about the pandemic not just as a medical crisis, but as a social and structural crisis, to think about the crisis of policing, and also the politics of protest. You know, we saw an extraordinary set of nationwide and indeed global protests that left me inspired and excited, and a little frustrated, you know. But to see people on the streets of Minneapolis screaming for abolition was heartwarming. You know, I came up in the 90s. I remember when we were protesting to take Mumia off death row, or when we would hit the streets when Rodney King is beaten, and we just wanted, you know, we were hoping to arrest some cops or get the LAPD to not have a 99% clearance rate after police get investigated for killing us. And to see the progression, to see the kind of freedom dreams of critical resistance and other Black revolutionaries become to fruition in such a way that we're no longer the crazy extremists calling for abolition, but suddenly people in the House of in City Council and House of Representatives are having legitimate conversations about it, was somewhat extraordinary. And there was some frustration too. I mean, you know, to see those abolition conversations turn to defunding conversations, turn to reform conversations, turn to people in kente cloth taking knees, raises some questions again about how we can hold on to the kind of radical teeth of a movement. But it's there, and it's never been more possible than it is right now. And for that reason, despite all this frustration, all the contradictions of the moment, I've never been more confident that we'll be victorious. And that's what the book is about. It's about saying that despite all this stuff, despite all the efforts of the state to erase us, to marginalize us, to kill us, we're still here. But our existence isn't the only thing. We're also carrying with us a radical imagination and a radical dream that can get us somewhere else. And for me, that's an abolitionist vision. That includes reparations. That includes so many other things. But it's a vision that's affirmative, not just talking about what we don't want, but thinking about the world that we want to see, thinking about the structures that we want to create, the social relationships we want to have, the world we want to build is in front of us, and I believe in it. And I want to say one more thing. There's a sister on the front of this cover Lauren Corsi. I don't know her. I saw her at one of the rallies that I didn't go to again because I was in COVID hiding. Although I ended up getting COVID anyway, so much for that. But part of why I wanted her in the front, and part of why I love this image, is because so much of the freedom dream, so much of the radical imagination that we have, I think, is owed to Black women, and particularly the Black radical feminist tradition. When I think about the best moments of our tradition, so many of the most ambitious and robust and expansive and inclusive freedom dreams have been offered to us by Black women, and I'm very excited and inspired by that. And there's a wonderful book on Haymarket about the Combahee River Collective, and part of, you know, edited by Kanga, and part of what we learn at Combahee is, you know, these, it would have been perfectly appropriate for Black women to speak only against gender injustice, to speak only against patriarchy, to speak out only against sexism. But their freedom dream was inclusive of third world solidarity, inclusive of dismantling capitalism, inclusive of disrupting all the structures that render us less whole and less human than we otherwise could be. That's important to me. When I look at what critical resistance has done, when I look at the work that came out of the Bay with regard to prison abolition and dismantling the prison industrial complex, it comes out of people who could have just focused on a singular area, but the Joy Jameses and the Maryam Makabas and the Ruth Wilson Gilmores and the Angela Y. Davises, they had a different, more expansive freedom dream. And that's not exclusive to them, it's part of a long tradition, and we stand on their shoulders. And this book owes not just a conceptual debt, but a political debt and an ethical debt to that tradition and to those people. And so I'm glad to be a part of it. This is a small book, but I hope that it makes a contribution to the conversation, to those who are trying to organize, to those who are trying to teach, to those who are trying to study, to those who are trying to make sense of the world. And that's all I got to say. I don't want to be that book dude that talks too much. So I want to be in conversation with y'all. That's way more important to me. So again, thank y'all for being here. Thank y'all for talking to me.
I don't know if it's serendipitous or what, but that is right on time when we have this hideous debate already emerging from the smoldering pile of rubble that was this presidential election, where within hours you have these Democratic Party functionaries coming out of the gutter and the woodwork to tell us to calm down, to shut up, to unite and heal with the Republican Party that has donned a white robe, embraced the worst of Trumpism, that has championed the cause of white supremacy. These are the people we are supposed to heal and unify with, while the leadership of this party takes out their daggers and goes for AOC, for the Squad, for Cori Bush, for Jamal Bowman, for the left within its ranks who are trying to think beyond the parameters, think beyond what is possible. And so within that context, your book comes in to preserve the space for what you describe, what Robin Kelly has described, our freedom dreams, which is to not let our expectations be managed by this corrupt, destabilizing, demoralizing, dehumanizing system, but that we know that there is a possibility for a different kind of world, for a different kind a future that we have to be prepared to fight for. And so I captured that from your book almost immediately, which is why, you know, you could ask me 36 hours beforehand to write a foreword, and, you know, I would drop everything to do it, because I knew, like, this is an important book that people, especially in a sea of such terrible arguments, a sea of such confusion, we actually need clear politics. We need politics that are based in history, that are based in the traditions that you speak of, that are based in the struggles of Black people, but other marginalized and oppressed people who have tried to conjure this different vision of what humanity can be. And so, you know, I'm certainly glad to have assisted with that in terms of introducing the book, but you certainly did the heavy lifting, and I'm glad that the book is out. And I want to encourage people to not just read it, but to get together and talk about it and really dig into it and think about, you know, how do we act collectively to get to the kind of future that Mark imagines and that we all are struggling to win.
Yeah, I'm equally excited and honored to be a part of the conversation. You know, this year has been particularly, I wouldn't even say hard, it's just been very, very trying for a lot of people. What you did with this volume really, it really touched me in not just a cerebral way. I'd like to say I know a lot of this stuff in here, but the memory of this, even for this year, was important. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate to be able to talk to you all about it.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm interested to know what y'all think about sort of this election piece of, you know, obviously at some point you got to stop writing and, you know, for this book to come out. And so the election was happening. We were entering the thick of things. I'll be honest, but it's interesting because I'm not sure how radically different a Biden moment will be with regard to many of the issues that are raised here, you know, and I think all of us were fairly publicly supportive of the Sanders campaign in the Democratic primary. And part of why I was, and that was honestly the first time that I had sort of publicly supported any candidate outside of the Green Party in a very long time. And the reason was because I thought that there might be an opportunity to not just sort of keep fascism at arm's length, but to actually move in the other direction, to actually imagine some new possibilities. And once that did not happen, and we had Biden as the alternative option, I still thought Biden was a better alternative to Trump. And I had to be pragmatic in ways that I perhaps haven't been before, that I definitely maybe haven't been before. But I also want to be mindful to those who are thinking about this stuff, particularly in the kind of joy of November 3rd and November 4th and really like November 7th. To, you know, as we're dancing in the streets and people are celebrating and all the stuff that happens when you watch fascism end, or when you think fascism has ended, to think about how so many of the things that forced us into such extraordinary vulnerability in the last 10 months are not particular to Donald Trump or the Trump presidency. There are ways that Trump's mismanagement of COVID-19 has led to unnecessary death, no doubt about that. There's a way that his response to the crisis in terms of the types of reforms he looked for, the type of economic interventions he went to, left certain small business owners and everyday working people more vulnerable than they otherwise could have been. There's no doubt about that. But part of what I want to get at in the book, and I think you all are pointing to it quite accurately, is that the conditions for this type of crisis and disaster were already there. And there's an extraordinary confluence of things that are happening, like a global health pandemic that we didn't fully anticipate, and maybe the worst president in modern American history. That combination, right, is a particular thing. But the conditions that allow a Walmart or a Target to exploit that are already there. The prisoners who are the people who are incarcerated, you know, they're. The conditions that allow them to be exploited so that they're making hand sanitizer and they're protective equipment, but can't. And the idea that we're okay with that as a general public because of the disposability of those who are in the car is a pre-existing structural condition that would have happened under Joe Biden. Because remember, it's Andrew Cuomo that's being celebrated for straightening up New York. It's the heir apparent of Democratic leadership who's being celebrated for how he managed New York City, while those aging incarcerated folk are still in prison dying, right? Well, I mean, so we have to think about that. The nursing homes weren't properly addressed. People, and even before Trump, hundreds of thousands of people die in nursing homes of preventable infections. This is part of the disposability culture that we operate in. Mm. This happens anyway. The set of economic conditions that allow Amazon to exist as an economic behemoth didn't start, you know, in 2016. So I don't want to understate the significance of getting rid of Donald Trump, absolutely important. But when you usher in a Biden presidency that says they believe in quote unquote law and order, they don't believe in defunding, they don't support a Green New Deal, he thinks billionaires should exist. He identifies as Zionist. I mean, we could go on down the list of things. We have to, one, manage our expectations, but also have give ourselves the charge to know what our work is, which is the point of Kanga's wonderful article, right? The work starts now of moving Biden and these centrist Democrats to the left instead of stigmatizing and demonizing and marginalizing those even those Democrats like the Squad and others who actually were trying to articulate a more progressive agenda. We have to say that's the bar, that's the standard, and we have to start moving even them to the left a bit, as opposed to this kind of pragmatic politics that doesn't work out for us and leaves the vulnerable incredibly in a greater state of precarity. So, I mean, part of what I'm wondering is, first of all, how y'all feeling after the election, what y'all kind of analysis is, and how you think this Biden move is going to impact these things we're talking about around pandemic and protesting and policing and stuff like that.
Well, I'll just say that I agree with all that. I think that, you know, the Democrats would love for us to believe that Trump is the root of all evil. And, you know, once you pull that root up, then we can get back to normal. And as many people have alluded to, the normal is what gave us Donald Trump, right? Black Lives Matter erupted during Barack Obama's presidency. Occupy Wall Street erupted during Barack Obama's presidency. And the failure of the Obama administration in two terms to adequately, really substantively respond to the crises that have been created by George W. Bush is what created the conditions for Donald Trump to be president. And so if the Biden administration thinks that they can kind of wax on about bipartisanship and unity and creating reforms on, you know, Mitch McConnell's terms or, you know, John Kasich's terms, then they're going to be in for a rude awakening, because I believe that he had about an 8-hour honeymoon that was Saturday night. People were dancing in the streets, and, you know, Biden has always been on the right of the Democratic Party, a deficit hawk. You know, we can't have deficits. We don't want to spend. But that's exactly what this moment calls for. And I think we have all seen, you know, the long, hot summer has turned into the warm fall, right? I mean, there was an uprising in Philly 2 weeks ago. The National Guard was deployed to Philadelphia 2 weeks ago. So the protests have continued. You know, the election has eclipsed everything, but the organizing, the protest, the anger, the bitterness has not gone away. And, you know, I don't believe that it will be stuffed in a box and put away so that Joe Biden has time to roll out his agenda. We don't have time. There are more cases in the United States today than there ever have been. The pandemic is raging completely out of control in this country, and we still have this criminal administration in power for another 10 weeks. God knows what will happen in the next 10 weeks with these lunatics at the helm. And so that is a recipe for continued conflict and confrontation. And again, to come back to the book, that is when politics and history is most crucial. Because demonstrations just for the sake of demonstrating, and demonstrations, you know, on in and of themselves are important, but they're not enough. Because at some point, then we have to argue for what we want. We have to make demands. We have to be organized so that we can consistently press for those demands, that we can figure out what has worked and what has not worked in one place or another, and have that impact and change our organizing. And for all of that, it means we need greater conversation, politics, cohesion. And, you know, I think Mark's book, especially when we're talking about the pandemic, which is at the center of everything happening in American society and the globe, you know, that it comes at a critical time when we need to figure out, you know, how, what is our posture in this moment when we have, it's easy when you have evil in the administration. It makes, you know, who the enemy is, it makes coming together, it makes all of that easy. But now, when you have this duplicitous, when we go back, I mean, this is the thing about Trump, is that it's unvarnished neoliberalism, right? The arguments are quick, they're easy, because you just open the newspaper and you've got this buffoon standing there making all the arguments for you, connecting all the dots for you. It's really hard when you've got, you know, Joe Biden and the whole apparatus of the Democratic Party telling you one thing while something else is going on, creating this illusion that they actually care about your pain and care about what is happening to you while simultaneously not doing a damn thing about it or not doing enough about it. And so, you know, that is a much harder road to hoe, although people learn more about what we're up against in those conditions. So it's a, you know, it's we're in for a rough ride, but, you know, this is the good thing about Haymarket, is politically kind of gearing us up to be able to understand it, to know what we see in front of us, and then to try to do something about it.
I mean, I'm not just saying it. You took the notes right off my page towards the end there. You know, the next Donald Trump will not be so me. He will. The next Donald Trump, and, you know, he could still run again. But I think what faces us is, you know, frankly, still 70 or so million people who sided with this openly monstrous person and personality. And probably half of the 70 or so million people who voted for Joe Biden who aren't really willing to go the whole road with us, right? And so, you know, I think that is the challenge before us right now. You said it, that's where I was going right there, that we've got to, energy doesn't dissipate. The energy and the anger that's happening in the streets is gonna either get focused inside towards a partner or some build black group or buy back the block group or a book club. That energy is going to get directed somewhere. And the Democrats, of course, hope that it would be directed into the promise of what they offer. But I think we've got to divide to unite. And I think we've got to continue to force a fracture within the Democratic Party. We've got to continue to draw that wedge. And this is a place of study for me. I don't know whether a third party is where we're going here. And I'm not against it at all. I'm just talking about how we actually do it on the state level and the federal level. But we've got to force this fracture within the Democratic Party. There are legitimate factions forming within the Democratic Party in a way that they haven't in maybe our generation. They were consolidated around a neoliberal agenda and they won out. And we now have legitimate factions forming within this Democratic Party that really, by and large, has no identity. The party doesn't. The factions do, seeking to run the party. And so I think we've got to continue to force that fracture. I think I don't know how controversial this comes off, but I think we've got to be deliberate in this moment of saying we are not preparing to roll out the red carpet for a Kamala presidency. Right, we are not willing participants in destiny, in a democratic destiny right now, right? And that is uncomfortable for people to say. The promise of a South Asian black woman president who is a AKA, I'm an alpha, you know, this is Ski Fi in the White House. I mean, this is amazing that we are not willing to lay down on the road to destiny, right? And say, this is what is going to happen. We need to be legitimate and say, you know, by 2024, we're going to be looking for completely new things to come out of the Democratic Party. And that is why we're forcing this fracture right now. And so I agree with everything Kianga said. I don't want to double up on anything, but you know, that's what's before us, to make sure that tranquility and passivity and all of those things that are talked about right now are thrown to the wind, and that that energy isn't subsumed by the Democratic Party as it stands right now. Now, there are some factions that I would definitely get behind, or at least get with, but we've got to continue to push.
I'll just say really quick, I think the 3-4, maybe one of them can double for that, sort of most polarizing issues are, of course, the police, and what people, the posture of defund the police as a bridge to abolition. This is clearly something that the leadership of the Democratic Party has come out all guns blazing on in the aftermath of the election. But I also think it's pandemic in terms of the rescue, the what package is going to be pushed through Congress. But connected to that is, of course, Medicare for all, and so. The issue with both of those is that we need overwhelming state intervention. And that is something the Republicans have rejected. They have abandoned people who have not received any unemployment or any kind of public intervention since July. These people broke their necks, stopped everything to push a bigot through onto the Supreme Court. And meanwhile, you have people facing eviction, hunger, illness in the country that have been left to their own devices. And so Medicare for all and the response to the pandemic, because it's not just the Republicans who are loath to make those kinds of expenditures, but it's also half the Democratic Party, you know, wants to tout its own credentials is reining in spending, is not, you know, being the tax and spend liberals of old. And so that has been the conflict with Bernie Sanders throughout, which is Bernie Sanders is like, yes, big government, please, more big government. Okay. But, you know, we have big government, of course, for corporate America, and we have big government for the military, but we need big government for people who are actually suffering. But I also think housing, because then you're starting to talk about private property, which of course is the lifeblood of American capitalism. And what does it mean to say cancel the rent? Because all these other kind of, you know, weird halfway measures are really just literally kicking the can down the road. Because to think that, well, we don't have to cancel the rent, we can just keep pushing it off with these moratoria until January. Well, what the hell do you think is about to happen in January? That the people who have been unemployed or underemployed for the last 8 months are all of a sudden going to be able to pay 5, 6, 7 months of back rent? No. So that debt must end, or we are looking at a cataclysmic human catastrophe of, when we are talking about being in the middle of a third wave or a second wave of this deadly pandemic and throwing people into the streets in the months of January and February, I mean, what is happening, you know? And so those issues all confront the caution, conservatism of the Democratic Party. And there's no way to hide. And this is what I mean about the pandemic driving politics. You can't hide from it. You can't turn the page. You can't act as if it's not happening. You can try that, and then, you know, you can be Notre Dame and thousands of people can rush the field after the game. Okay, but let's check those, you know, rates of infection in South Bend, right? But you can't get away from it. It is stuck in the middle of everything. And so these are the issues that call the question as to what the Democratic Party is going to do. And if they do it wrong, 2022 is going to go down as the massacre of the Democratic Party. And okay. So, and that is when, you know, I think, I mean, this is probably for another book and another conversation, but, you know, the rescue of the Democratic Party, I haven't been convinced. You know, I just, these people, out of their cold, dead hands, they will be grasping this thing until it dies. And so I don't know what that means for us, but I think for our side, you know, we are lacking the kind of organizational apparatus that can allow us to influence public debate and public opinion and to engage on a high level and to bring all of our disparate smaller projects together into a larger organizational force. That's a much bigger question, but these are the kinds of existential realities that I think are animating American politics right now.
Agree. We're watching the slow death. You know, we've been watching it, but we're absolutely watching the slow death of the Democratic Party. I agree. It could be a bloodbath. And if we look at rising stars within the Republican Party, and if we listen to Donald Trump's speech from a few days ago, what did he say? We are now the party of working people. We are now the party of inclusion. You can go see it. Mm-hmm. We are now the party of working people. They already understand that they are witnessing a widely atrophied Democratic Party that barely was able to beat someone who willingly, publicly drove every single person in this country to the brink and barely beat them. You understand? This should have been landslide, 48 states, right? And was not able to do that because he was willing. We're not going to go in on, you know, he's gone, right? But he was willing. Donald Trump was willing to push him to say all manner of things. I support fracking. And so we're mm-hmm. witnessing that, and I think we need to observe that contradiction, know what time it is, and position ourselves for that place. The only other thing I'll add, and I know you would have, is student debt. I mean, if they do something around student debt, I think it underscores, in the same way that Kianga was saying with the other issues, it strikes at a pillar there. And I don't know how this is connected, but as I'm sitting and thinking to myself sometimes, you know, we're witnessing a real death of the educational system.
Yes.
And we've been witnessing it for a very, very long time. Young people, now more than ever, now that they're on computers, right, and just doing everything on computers, now understand that they do not need the university to do what they want to do in their life. They can do all manner of, maybe you need it to do what you want to do in your life, become a doctor or a lawyer, but not to make money, right? Not to become in some way financially stable. You can be a YouTube star, you could be a TikTok star, you could be a model, you can do all these things without need for the university. And so there's another contradiction there with our educational system. They also know that going to university doesn't also guarantee them any place in work life as well. And so I just think if we can push a conversation with the millions of students that currently have debt, and I would just add that to housing, absolutely, to policing. The only thing I'll say about defund the police, and I'll keep it super brief, is I do think our movement has to exercise the muscle. And we've already said defund the police, refund the communities. We've also got to talk about, you know, we've got to completely, and we're doing it. I'm not saying we're not, but every time we say defund, every time I say it, I say we have to first minimize and completely restructure the system that creates the need for police, right? And so that's safety. And I know we all know that, but I just think the muscle around saying that on the street is going to be essential, because we are, with defund the police specifically, we are getting to a place where the cities are going to do it. And there's going to be one mass robber who knocks over an old lady, and the police are going to say, look, our hands were tied. You know, we want to be there for Black people. We want to be there for our Latino brothers and sisters. but this movement in the streets that doesn't like anybody that doesn't agree with them, that burns things down, has now taken away our budget, and Miss Nelly is now dead because of it. Their blood is on your hands. And so we've got to, in what Kianga said, we've got to build the communications bulwark and the political education bulwark over the next few years to really bring our folks along.
They already said it in Philly with the murder of Walter Wallace. The police chief, ignobly named Danielle Outlaw, said that the reason why the cops didn't have tasers was because they have been defunded. They've lost their money. And otherwise, they could have tased Mr. Wallace. So, yes, they are already cynically looking to deploy that argument whenever they can.
Yeah, no, I think you're both right. And I think political education is the key to helping to reshape those conversations. Again, that's part of why I wrote the book, was so that people could be equipped to have those conversations and to articulate that. Because, again, so much of what we've talked about as a movement is what we don't want. And I think it's so important to talk about the world we want to see and what it will look like. This idea of producing realities where people's needs are met is a whole different conversation. And I agree. I think in the case of Walter Wallace is a really good one. His mother calls the police three times that Monday for mental health support. He's in crisis. She needs help. She has no one else to call but the police. And so if we reduce the conversation to whether or not the police had tasers, which is what the police want to do, then it starts the conversation with the presumption that police have to exist as such, right? And that the response to a mental health crisis should be resolved by police. Similarly, when when Rayshard Brooks gets killed in a Wendy's parking lot in Atlanta, he was drunk, he fell asleep in the parking lot, the police show up, and a whole string of things happen, and the debate becomes, well, he took the taser. And he ran with the taser. And it's like, yeah, we could critique the police's response to that. Look, he took the taser and ran away. You have his driver's license. He going home eventually, right? You didn't have to shoot him. There's a way to make that argument. But again, the more fundamental problem is, I'm a Wendy's drive-thru worker. I'm overworked and underpaid. I just want to go home. And there's a dude in the drive-thru sleep, drunk. And the only person I can call in this moment is someone with a gun whose primary understanding and training will prompt him to escalate this to maybe a death sequence. And so before this drunk man makes whatever choices he makes with the police that we could critique or not, before the police show up, before we make a decision about what the police could have done, because in all the hour they took interrogating him, they could have drove him home, you know what I mean, threw the keys in the house and called it a day. But before any of that happened, we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be in a place where the only person I can call in crisis is the police? And that's a more fundamental question about how society operates. And it's very difficult to tell someone who's a victim of sexual assault, of domestic violence, etc., that, all right, we're gonna stop calling the police right now. Because that comes from a place of both gender and class privilege to be able to even say that I have access to other resources to resolve the crisis. So structurally, we have to, and I think Phil's right, we have to be able to imagine and ultimately imagine, offer, and then install new social structures and mechanisms so that as we're saying we're going to defund the police, what are we refunding? You know, what are we refunding? Because to say refund the community, if we replicate the police force through other means, right, then we haven't really done that much, right? Although I think just having a disarmed public safety force would be an extraordinary step forward. Again, what's the ultimate goal? What's the ultimate project here? And I think we have to begin to think through that. And I think that same argument can be made in all these other sectors of life, whether it, and I think, and this is the last thing I'll say, because I know Jim wants to, I think we're almost time for Q&A, yeah, is the state in some ways tipped its hand, right? I mean, I think about all the arguments we had in Cobra back in the day, all the debates people have had on even on Twitter in the last 5 years about reparations. And whenever reparations comes up, the first thing they say is, well, where are we gonna find the money? Who are we gonna give it to? How are we gonna decide who needs it? Da 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 da. Mm-hmm. COVID comes, they giving out, as you say in the hood, they giving out stimmies left and right, right? We get the $1,200 checks pop. They found people to give it to real quick when America's economic vitality was on the line.
Right.
Right. When we talk about abolition, and just one of the key pieces of abolition is decarceration, right? And excarceration, mm-hmm. right? Both getting people out of prison and also not using the prison as the kind of resolution to these social contradictions and crises, right? But suddenly when COVID hit, the state was like, oh wait, yeah, we can let them out. They're not violent. Oh wait, some of them, yeah, they can go. Right. Not enough, clearly not enough. But my point is they were able to use decarceration strategies when it benefited them. You know, we're not gonna lock up the small time drug abusers. We're not gonna lock up the small, we don't have the resources because the cops didn't want to get COVID. Right? So there's a moment where suddenly giving out money and decarcerating folk was possible when it was in the state's interest. And so we always knew it was possible, even though they told us we were crazy. Now, I think the people have seen what's possible in a more robust way. And so I hope that energy allows us to think through how to resolve these problems around mass incarceration of the vulnerable, around lack of access to housing. I mean, again, the structural question is not how do we give people money to pay their rent? It's asking the more fundamental question, which Kianga gets in her brilliant new book, about the role of land ownership and of profit making around housing in the first place, right? In the same way, we're calling into question the actual idea of policing. Let's call into question the actual idea of the landlord, the idea of housing being such a crucial piece here, right? And how we access it, rather. These are more fundamental and interesting questions that I think we're going to have to bring forward to those squarely in power, and that's the work we have to do no matter who's president, because all of them are way to the right of where we need to be. And that's what has me encouraged, though, is that this moment, you know, Dr. King said only when it's darkest can you see the stars. I mean, 2020 is dark, right? But the stars are this activism, the stars are the organizing, the stars are the new radical possibilities that used to only be at the world, you know, the social forum or our book talks or, you know, in an independent bookstore or the radical, you know, thread on Twitter. Now suddenly we talking about this in public space with decent folk, you know what I'm saying? And we can have this conversation in a different way, and I'm energized and I'm excited by it. Anyway, Jim, I know we got some people who got questions and comments, so let's do that too.
Yeah, this conversation has been brilliant and really, really refreshing and helpful. We've got a lot of questions, some really great questions. We can only get to a few, but so I'm going to try to bring together a couple of them. I mean, I think some of what Mark was just talking about, there's a lot of questions about organization and mobilization in this moment. And I think I'll combine two parts of it. One is, what do you all see as vehicles or organizations that can, you know, help us organize resistance in this moment? And secondly, you know, I think we've been hearing so much about, you know, who's Biden going to put on his transition team and all of that. But what are the what do wins for the movement? I mean, you talked about the fault lines that are coming up in the Democratic Party, but what do wins for the movement under a Biden administration look like? So, you know, both local organizing, national organizing perspectives, et cetera. Yeah.
So I'll just say, I think that, you know, there's two approaches as we see that the capitalist state can take. One is treating everyone the way that the meatpacking industry treated its workforce, which is, we're just going to let the virus rip, and if you can't handle it, you'll die. Everyone else will get it. We'll force herd immunity, and we'll just move on and act as if nothing is happening. And then there's the other response, which is that actually won't work with the economy, because you need people to not be afraid for their lives. Schools will not open because there are teacher unions. People ask, why is everybody else gone back to work except teachers? Because they have unions. That's why. And so unions and teachers will not die for public school systems. Who refuse to, you know, fix things so that they are actually safe, because they don't have the money. The money is being restrained from the Trump administration because they're trying to force people back out during the pandemic. So my expectation is that Biden administration will it rationally come to the conclusion that this strategy has failed, and that we need to try something different, that they might use the production capacities of the legislation that Trump used to make 40 billion what are those things, ventilators, mm-hmm. but no gloves, no masks, and no gowns, that they might actually use that legislation or executive order to create the 95 masks for healthcare providers, that they might release federal money and make that available to cities and states so that they can actually function, that they might be able to conjure some deal or something so that people get some money, and that it's not, as AOC described it, the free fall into hell. And so I think any response, to be honest, would be a win, because there has been no response. The federal government has thrown up its hands and said, you guys are on your own. No one is in control. So having some intervention, I think, as far as like groups, I mean, there are a lot of groups. There are a million different groups doing a million different things. I think for me, it's those are great, but we also need big groups. We need what one might describe as mass organizations that allow the different groups to be in touch with each other, but that also mean that the mass can flex its side, whether that is through collective, more organized demonstrations that concentrate our forces, whether it's the creation of publications that allow us to influence ideas and politics and debates in ways that we don't now, that has been totally left to the right and the Republican Party, who do that all the time and through the mainstream media and through their own types of media. So we have to, you know, because I don't think that as a left, we have the collective power and ability to do those things yet, because we are enormously dispersed right now. And so that's not to say we need one big group doing one single thing, but we do need more collaboration, cohesion, communication between the proliferating smaller groups of people who are doing tremendously important work on the ground, but that many of us aren't actually in communication with.
It has been an incredible conversation. It's a shame to cut it short, but I do want to remind people to pick up a copy of Mark's book, continue the conversation in your local networks, national networks, et cetera. In the chat, we'll be posting some upcoming Haymarket events, including on Wednesday with David Harvey and Amna Akbar, on Thursday with S.A. Smythe, Zoe Samudzi, Badur Alagra, and Robin D.G. Kelly. And so I'll just give you all the last word. If you want to close with any, we've covered so much ground about possibility, but it feels like we could end on a question of, you know, possibility.
You know, I'll be real brief, man. I am I'm so excited again to be here with everybody. This moment is so dark and it's so frustrating and it's so exhausting. But I honestly have never been more certain that we'll be victorious. And I said that at the beginning, and I want to say that at the end. I've never been more certain. The energy is there. The ideas are there. I mean, there's a generation of people on the street right now. Forget about there are people on the street right now who in their first actions were calling to defund and abolish police. I mean, that's some shit. We just did that was outside of the realm of possibility for us 20 years ago. Again, we might say it at Critical Resistance, we might mm-hmm. talk about it, but on the streets and in Congress, you know what I mean? I mean, what's possible right now is so much clearer to me. And so I'm inspired by that. I'm excited by the possibilities, and I'm excited by the fact that despite the moment, people are still invested in ideas and people are still invested to struggle. And they keep trying to kill us. You know, and two more quick things. One, I didn't say this at the beginning. I do want to send love and shout out my comrade and brother, Frank Barat, for engaging me in the conversations that allowed this book to happen. You know, the conversations with Frank were critical to this, and I didn't want to ignore that. But they've tried to do everything they can to marginalize us, to erase us, to kill us, to destroy us, you know, and we still here, and we always will be. And I want people to know that as they enter this next leg of the fight, because this one is going to be a tougher one. This is the one that's going to make you a little bit more lonely. Mm-hmm. You know, being in the battle against Trump makes you the majority, right? You king in 63. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's time to be king in 68. Mm-hmm. And that's a different kind of battle. That's the stuff that gets you lonely. And you might not have 100,000 people, which you might just have 100. But as Fidel said, it'll be with those who had absolute faith. And that it's better to make revolution with a small number of people with absolute faith. And that's what we're going to do right now. And when we win, everybody will say they were with you. That's how every action is, right? Once you're successful, everybody pretended they were there the whole time. But this small number of people are going to make victory happen. We're going to do it. We're going to win. And I just want everybody to know that and to be excited by that, to be energized by that. And so when we have those lonely moments, let's turn to each other. Let's study together. Let's read. Let's find moments for joy. Let's find moments for laughter. But let's keep fighting. Let's keep pressing. And we will win because we're still here.
So for me, as I've alluded to a few times, I'm working with an organization called Black Men Build. As the name implies, we're hoping to build Black men. It's a place for Black men to engage this country and the world politically, but we're not Black men for Black men's sake. We want to be a place, as I said earlier, where Black men can come as they are and grow as they go. We want to be a part of the building of a new man, a man that feels, a man that loves, a man that can express the vulnerabilities and intimacies that are entitled to all human beings. And I want for anybody who is on here, who's a friend of one, to get them involved with us. And so my last word is an organizing push, because we are losing as we refuse to or are scared of or are tired of. Organizing or reaching out to Black men, we are losing them, and we're vanishing from all manner of places. And as was also said, this isn't about decentering anyone at all. We want to bring Black men into the movement as servants, as stewards, as leaders, as speakers, as servers. But we cannot have them on the sidelines or being recruited by the right any further or any longer. Mm. And for the comrades on the left, I'll leave with my absolute favorite quote, and I think should guide us, from Amilcar Cabral: hide nothing from the masses of the people, tell no lies, expose lies whenever they are told, mask no difficulties, mistakes, or failures, claim no easy victories.
That's great. Thanks to Haymarket for putting this event together. I really, you know, Mark and Phil are two of my favorite people that I always love to talk about politics and possibilities, and, you know, also basketball. I have texted Mark in the middle of the night watching a Sixers game, only for him to pick up at what was like 2 a.m. in Amman, Jordan, and say that somehow he too was watching this game. So it runs deep. Yeah. What the only thing I will add is, you know, I don't think that we're a small minority. I think that we're actually a majority. And when we look at like the issues and causes that are most important to us, they are, you know, robust majorities. That I think that we are going with the stream around Medicare for all, around multi-trillion dollar packages for COVID, around a solution to the housing question. And for those who aren't fully with us, they're open to what it is that we have to say. And so my mantra has been that we have to develop the tools to communicate our ideas, to engage in the battle of ideas, and to fight for people and not just throw up our hands and dismiss people because they don't immediately agree with us, because that's not politics. And if that's our posture, you know, then our movement's not going to grow. And if we think that we can fight the right in this reactionary machine of both Democrats and Republicans, with, you know, us and our 12 best friends who have figured it all out, then we are sadly mistaken. And so we need a posture of engagement, of openness, of being hard on, you know, issues of racism and gender discrimination and sexism and all of that, but with the understanding that people's ideas are fluid. People are fluid, that what you think today might not be what you think a week from now. But we can't do that if we have a posture of non-engagement. And so now, you know, it's clearer where things are at and the battles that will need to be fought, you know, and we have to really engage with that and create the tools that are necessary to try to win the mass movement that we need in order to be successful. And I'm, you know, I am optimistic about that just from what I saw in the streets this past summer. 15 to 26 million people, white people in places where there are no black people, who came out in defiance of public authorities to say that Black Lives Matter. I think that is an important foundation that our movement can build upon and grow in the ways that we want, that we think are important in this struggle for a better world. So thanks again for organizing this. It's been a great conversation.
That was a conversation sponsored by Haymarket Books, featuring Mark Lamont Hill, Philip Agnew, and Kianga Yamata Taylor about Dr. Hill's urgent new book, We Still Here: Pandemic, Policing, Protest, and Possibility. You can find more information on the book, We Still Here.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent